A rescue takes shape today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. 12 boys and their soccer coach survived more than a week in a flooded cave complex in Thailand before rescuers finally made contact.
How many of you?
13.
Brilliant. We are coming.
It's okay.
Many people are coming.
Now officials say it could be months before the group can get out. We'll have the latest on the rescue effort and on the toll that spending weeks trapped underground could have on the boys.
You face death. You face the prospect of never seeing all the people you love. And now that's one thing for a middle-aged man to live. But for a child, I mean, that is a very, very difficult thing.
That story and more coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's a story that's riveted people all over the globe this week. 12 boys and their soccer coach trapped inside a flooded cave in Thailand. Yesterday, local divers and an international rescue team finally made contact with the group after they were stuck there for 10 days. Rescuers swam through pitch black waters and twisted passageways to look for the boys. This is the moment when divers from the British Cave Rescue Council finally found them.
How many of you?
13.
Brilliant. We are coming. It's okay. Many people are coming.
Many people.
We are the first. Many people come.
What day?
Tomorrow.
No. What day is it?
Oh,
no. Monday.
Monday.
Okay, but 1 week and Monday. You have been here 10 days. 10 days. You are very strong.
Those were John Valentin and Richard Stanton, two of the divers from British Cave Rescue. Earlier today, we called Noporn Wong Anan for an update. He's the editor of the BBC's Thai service.
The authorities are working round the clock to find a way to get these boys and their coach out of the cave. They cannot swim nor can dive, but the authorities have sent 7 people inside. These are Navy divers who's been trained in warfare, and a doctor and a nurse who've been with the boy most of the time. And you have to imagine that this is a very, very dark and narrow passage. There are deep water inside. It takes 3 hours per journey to get in and out of the entrance of the cave to reach the boy.
It's just an amazing story. And I guess what I understand is these boys and their coach, the cave flooded and they had to kind of push further and further in to find a little high ground.
Precisely. And this is a 10 kilometers long cave. People in the neighborhood have been warned for generations not to even venture into this cave because they've been said that this is a maze. But these boys are quite adventurous, and this is not the first time that they've been in there, but this time it was unfortunate.
You mentioned the cave complex is about 10 kilometers long. That's about 6.5 miles. And how far into it are they?
Well, the way it goes is that there are different chambers into the cave. There are both dry ground and wet ground. So the authorities have made the third chamber as their storage to keep all their supplies for food, diving gear, oxygen tanks. And so you have to have people who bring in these supplies into the chamber. And then you have the divers to dive and bring in these food supplies to the boys. And that's another 2 or 3 kilometers away.
Are the divers who go in and deliver food and talk to them, do they get right up on that high ground where the boys and their coach are, or do they pass things to them?
They pass things to them. If you've seen the video that captured the first moment when the boys were found, the rescuers, the diver, could not get to them. They only were shouting at one another from another part because the water is very deep. But what we believe now that the divers are with the boys now, keeping them company, making sure that they are fed and they are in good spirit. And if they can find some time to teach them how to dive or how to use simple diving gear to get out.
What do we know that they survived on during the 9 days they were there before the rescuers reached them? I mean, what did they eat or drink?
We have no information yet, but some parents or some people were saying that they intend to go on expedition in this cave, so they brought in some food and drink, but that wouldn't last them for 10 days, for sure.
Have Thai authorities decided that they will teach the kids to swim and dive and get them out in that manner, or are they still debating how they're going to get the kids and the coach out?
They have the worst-case scenario and good-case scenario. The worst-case scenario is that they bring the food supplies of 4 months long to store at this Chamber 3 to make sure that these kids are healthy, are capable of diving out of the cave. But the problem is that because it's a monsoon season and the water from the rain flood the cave most of the time, they were quite lucky in the past 2 days that the rain stopped. So then they were able to drain the water out shallow enough for the diver to get in there. So they are racing against time to make sure that the water is shallow enough for the diver to get in and for the boys to get out. On the other hand, they need to make sure that the boys are strong enough and know enough of the skill to dive out or swim out of that area.
And as you said, these boys don't know how to swim. And as I understand it, if they did the dive to get out, they'd be in dark water, kind of groping their way through narrow passages underwater.
Yeah, but so the authorities have techniques to teach these boys how to dive out. So they were talking about this full face mask to get them out, or even stretchers, or all kind of ways that they can think of to get the boys out of this place safely. And today we had an assurance from the governor of the area saying that they would take zero risk in taking the boys out. Whoever are not strong enough or not ready to get out yet, they will wait.
It's just an incredible story. Naporn Wong Anan is the editor of the BBC's Thai service. He joined me earlier to discuss the latest from the caves. Thanks so much, Naporn.
You're welcome.
It's hard to think about the group of boys stuck in a cave in Thailand without remembering a similar story in Chile. Back in 2010, a mountainside collapsed in northern Chile, sealing 33 miners inside. They were more than 2,000 feet underground for 69 days. And while they were down there, the miners made a pact that if they survived, they would tell their story to one person. That person was journalist Hector Tobar, author of the book Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. Hector Tobar joins us from Los Angeles. And Hector, when you heard about the news from Thailand, what first came to mind?
Oh, absolutely. I thought about those 33 men and the 69 days that they spent trapped underground and all the drama and the emotional turmoil that they lived through in those 2 months.
You spoke extensively to the rescued miners in Chile. And based on that experience, what can you tell us about what you think these kids, I think they range in age from like 11 to 18, and they have a 25-year-old coach with them. What do you think they're going through right now?
Well, I think that what they went through in those 9 days when they weren't certain they were going to be rescued is probably the most difficult thing that they went through, because you're facing death. With those Chilean miners, they spent 17 days not certain they would ever be rescued, sitting in the dark in a kind of tomb. You face death. You face the prospect of never seeing all the people you love. And now that's one thing for a middle-aged man to live. But for a child, I mean, that is a very, very difficult thing.
In the case of the Chilean miners, what kept them going?
One of the lucky things that the boys have, like the miners did, is that they're together. They're with other people. And so you have these relationships that actually grow deeper. Those miners became a brotherhood, really, especially in those first 17 days they were trapped when they thought they were all going to die together. And just whatever relationships they had between them before, the miners had some natural leaders emerge. I can imagine that coach stepping forward, some of the older boys stepping forward to keep the younger boys going. That kind of dynamic played out in the San Jose mine over those days, too.
In those days when the miners were there in the dark, not knowing if they would be rescued, did they create routines to keep them going?
Oh, absolutely. They had very limited food supply, and so they rationed the food supply. There were places where they could go and get fresh water. They very quickly learned to ration the battery supply and the light that they had. They found places to go to the bathroom. The stuff of just daily life that you have to do to keep going, that's part of the survival instinct too, is routine. And actually, routine is also what's going to keep these boys going as they wait to be rescued.
With the miners, did they remain hopeful, or were they kind of having to buoy each other and reassure each other in those days before anybody reached them?
Well, in the days before anyone reached them, a lot of them were preparing to die. I think being older men, some of them were writing farewell letters. When they were found, that was an incredible moment. That was this burst of adrenaline and hopefulness to have somebody emerge through the walls of the mine that they were trapped in. And for the boys, someone to emerge from the water with a flashlight and saying, "You're here," to realize that the outside world really was looking for you. I mean, for the miners, that was their big doubt. Is anyone really going to care about us? And to find that an entire country was united to try and find them and get them out of there was this miracle for them. And so for these boys as well, I imagine that the knowledge that the whole country's out there, the whole world is really looking to you and hoping that you'll get out, that is something that is going to give them a lot of energy in the days and weeks to come.
What's happened to the miners since their rescue?
Well, I think the first couple of years were very difficult for many of the miners. The Chilean government and the doctors who were in charge of their care did a great job while they were still trapped in the mine, but didn't do a very good job of looking after their psychological welfare in the weeks and months and years that followed. A lot of them suffered from deep depression. At first, they felt they were going to be abandoned. They were going to die in the dark. Then they became famous. They thought they were going to become rich. And so they went through this swirl of emotions, this back and forth between feeling lonely and lost and confused and feeling like they were never going to have to work again, like they were national heroes. So there's a lot of different range of emotions that those men went through. Yes, a couple of men did actually go work underground again, but most of them found jobs above ground in the mining industry. Some of them, like Mario Sepulveda, found work doing motivational talks, you know. The sooner they went back to work, it was actually better for them.
Did the government give them any compensation for what happened to them or the company that ran the mine?
The company that ran the mine did not. The company that ran the mine went bankrupt. They've been sued, and those lawsuits dragged on in the courts for years. The government has provided all the miners with a stipend and some of them with extra retirement benefits.
These kinds of stories of people being trapped deep underground in the dark, waiting to be rescued, not knowing if they ever will be rescued. What do these stories represent to you as an author and storyteller?
That's a great question. A lot of it is about our sort of collective psyche. You know, these guys are trapped underground, and we all imagine ourselves in that same situation. So there's that aspect of the global human story, and the way these stories of people trapped sort of remind us all of our common humanity. Now, for the men underground, what I found interviewing them was that this really was a love story, that when they were trapped in the dark, thinking they were going to die, they could think about their lives, reflect on their lives, and they realized that what was great about their lives was the people who loved them. That really was the only meaningful thing that they had really done in their lives. What was really important was that there were people above ground who loved them and wanted them back home. And I hope that these young boys who are trapped have a similar kind of epiphany and a realization about how special their relationships are with their families.
Hector Tobar is the author of Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine. Thanks a lot, Hector.
Thank you.
Coming up, some of the people from Puerto Rico displaced by Hurricane Maria got some good news today. That's ahead, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico back in September. Since then, thousands of people have come to the mainland and been able to get free housing thanks to a federal aid program. The Transitional Shelter Assistance Program is run by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The program was set to expire over the weekend. Then a federal judge issued a temporary extension until tomorrow. Today, that judge extended the deadline yet again to July 23rd. Cristela Guerra is a reporter with the Boston Globe and has been following the story. Cristela, tell us about the news we got today about this program being extended, because the way I understand it, it's already been extended several times.
Yeah, it's been extended 4 times by FEMA, then 2 times by the courts in actually the last few days. It was set to end June 30th. That was the day that was set by the governor of Puerto Rico. That was the day that was set to families since May. And then Friday, a national civil rights group filed for an emergency temporary restraining order to stop the expiration date. Most families I spoke to expected to have to check out by July 1st. So Sunday morning at 11 or 12, many were in the lobby. Many didn't know about the injunction. Many hotels weren't notified. But what it did mean was that they had a temporary stay of a day or so, and now they have about 2 weeks.
How many families are currently living in hotels here on the mainland under this program?
You know, it's hard to say. I have been getting updated numbers from FEMA as often as I can. They change every day, not only because there's a transportation assistance program that offers flights back to Puerto Rico. So plenty of people taking advantage of that, thinking they wouldn't have anywhere to go after Sunday. As of last Wednesday, there were nearly 2,000. As of yesterday, there were nearly 500.
Now, this is across the nation.
This is across the nation. And it was in several states. Some states had very little. Some states had more. Florida and New York have more. That being said, whether people went back to families' homes, whether they went to shelters, it's not totally clear.
As of today, families can stay through at least July 23rd. Any sense of what's going to happen after that?
When I spoke to the attorneys that filed for the injunction, there's many, and they're representing 8 families in Massachusetts and Florida in a class action lawsuit. What their hope is, they wanted the 30-day extension. They wanted the opportunity to present more information to Judge Hillman, Timothy Hillman. He's a U.S. District Court judge, and their hope is that it'll eventually go to a formal hearing, present testimony, I mean, really get a day in court for these families.
But what's the goal? Is the goal of the families who are being housed to stay for a specific period of time indefinitely? What is the goal?
So it's interesting. The challenge has been, during Katrina, TSA was extended for 18 months. It's been less than a year. So the attorneys would say, these people should have the same opportunity as those during Katrina and Sandy to get their lives back together. The other challenge I've heard from people is because the extensions aren't known until right before the deadline, and there have been 4 extensions, those who've had jobs have left jobs because they've gone from hotels to different hotels in different parts of the state. It also means taking their kids out of one school and putting them in another school. So it's been quite chaotic.
Will there actually be a day in court to wrestle this, or is it up to the government to simply say, okay, we're going to do it like Katrina, or we're not?
I think FEMA's argument during there was a telephonic hearing on Monday is ultimately other cases have shown that it really is up to them to decide the time, and it's their working on behalf of the governor of Puerto Rico. If the governor wanted to extend TSA, he could. But he said until June 30th, and there's been no extension offered beyond that. So that's why these 2 extensions have really been very much last minute. And it makes families, at least the ones that I've spoken to, feel like their lives are being toyed with.
Is the Transitional Shelter Assistance Program run by FEMA, is that the only federal assistance displaced Puerto Ricans are receiving right now?
No, there's many different programs. This seemed to be the most, I think, appealing to a lot of folks because it meant that they were getting out of the circumstances they were in. Many said they were accepted quickly, and they came here, I think, from what I gather, assuming that it would be a pretty easy process, that they would be able to find work and get back on their feet. But what they found is that's not the case.
Of the many hundreds of Puerto Ricans here in the U.S. temporarily, do they know what they're going back to? Is there rebuilding going on in Puerto Rico so there's a plan for when they get back to resume work?
I know in certain parts, more metro areas, cities, there's work being done. But they're also saying that there's power is spotty. Some places still don't have water. So from what these families have told me, they feel like it's the beginning of another hurricane season. I lost my home. I want a new beginning here. And you're telling me to return to the place that I purposely fled last fall.
Cristela Guerra with the Boston Globe. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Another government deadline is coming up this week. This Thursday, the Department of Homeland Security will make a choice whether to extend temporary protected status for 1,200 Yemenis in the United States or tell them to leave the U.S. by September. That could mean deporting them back to a war zone.
To send a Yemeni back to Yemen at this time is simply a death sentence.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine, was one of 33 national security experts who signed a letter last week asking the State Department and Homeland Security to extend the Yemeni TPS program. Temporary protected status was first offered to Yemenis in September 2015. At the time, the Department of Homeland Security said that sending Yemenis home would pose a serious threat to their personal safety. Ambassador Bodine, who served in Yemen during the George W. Bush administration, says conditions in Yemen have only gotten worse.
The war is comfortably into its fourth year. 22 out of 29 million Yemenis are drastically food insecure. They're on the verge of famine.
Stephen Sesh agrees. He's another former U.S. ambassador to Yemen who served during both the Bush and Obama administrations.
Water systems, municipal water systems, have been completely destroyed. There is an outbreak of cholera. And the notion that we could now forcibly return Yemenis to a country that has fallen into chaos completely bollocks my mind. I cannot imagine how we could do that.
TPS currently allows Yemenis to temporarily remain and work in the U.S. rather than return to face armed conflict. Bodine says Yemenis here do not represent a danger to the United States.
They are students. They are professionals. They are agricultural workers. They are janitors. They are not a fifth column for terrorism. These are people who are trying to get away from the violence and get away from the humanitarian crisis.
One TPS recipient named Mohammed spoke with us. He asked that we use only his first name. These days, Mohammed drives a delivery truck in Washington state. He and his family fled their home in the Yemeni capital Sana'a back in 2015. And Mohammed says he's afraid to return because both sides of the war would demand his allegiance.
If you are in Sana'a, if you back and stay in Sana'a, you have to decide, fight with us or you are not with us.
Mohammed says that happened to him. The Houthis, the rebel group who run his city, wanted him to join their army. But there was equal pressure on young men elsewhere to fight against the Houthis.
The situation there, if you are not with us, you are our enemy.
We contacted Homeland Security and the State Department, but there's no word yet on the TPS decision. By Thursday, Mohammed and some 1,200 other Yemenis will learn whether they'll wait out the war here in the U.S. or be forced to go home to a war in progress. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia gives us his take on the upcoming Trump-Putin summit.
I'm not against summits in general, but they have to be in the pursuit of American national interests. They cannot be just a have a good meeting.
Plus, what makes a summit a summit? That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The last U.S. president to hold a one-on-one summit with Vladimir Putin was George W. Bush. I'm old enough to remember 2001, when Bush met Putin and described the Russian leader as straightforward and trustworthy. Bush said he was even able to get a sense of Putin's soul. Bush and Putin held a total of three summits. Things never worked out too well. U.S.-Russian relations have been pretty frosty for quite some time. Enter President Donald J. Trump. There's an ongoing investigation into possible collusion between Russia and the 2016 Trump campaign, but the president's supporters say that relations with Moscow are not good and that a Trump-Putin summit could help fix the problem. Michael McFaul was President Obama's ambassador to Moscow and now teaches political science at Stanford. Ambassador McFaul, what makes a summit, as opposed to just a meeting of two leaders?
Well, that's a good question, because President Trump and President Putin have already met on the sidelines of a multilateral meeting. And that often happens between presidents and prime ministers. But when they meet just one-on-one, not on the sidelines, that's when we traditionally use this word summit. And so President Obama, who I worked for at the White House before going to Moscow as his ambassador, he had his first summit in July 2009 when we traveled to Moscow to meet with President Medvedev. And so the standalone nature of it, I think, is what distinguishes summits from just bilats. That's the way it's referred to in the U.S. government on the sidelines of other meetings. By the way, President Obama had a planned summit with President Putin for September 2013. I spent a good year of my life preparing for that summit, but it was canceled because then President Putin gave asylum to Edward Snowden And President Obama decided that that was, you know, a provocative act that we couldn't just pretend was business as usual and move on.
Summits are often between adversaries. To what extent is that the case with Putin and Trump?
Well, I personally consider Russia to be a threat to many American national interests. And I think a good deal of containment is in order today, pushing back on President Putin, not just accommodating him. And I'm nervous about the concessions that President Trump has floated recently. I just don't think that is in the American national interest. And yet, I want to emphasize that even during the Cold War, when containment was a strategic objective, there were also moments of engagement with Soviet leaders. So I'm not against summits in general, and I think it's better to meet and discuss issues rather than to guess what your counterpart might think. But they have to be in the pursuit of American national interests. They cannot be just a have a good meeting, and a bunch of happy talk with President Putin. I think that would be a big, big victory for Putin if all the meeting achieved was some nice words for Vladimir Putin and nothing in return on our side.
Now, you're a noted Trump critic. What could President Trump do?
I consider myself a supporter of America. So when he does things that I think are in America's national interest, I praise him. For instance, his administration provided lethal assistance to the Ukrainian military. I supported that.
Ambassador McFaul, what could Trump do to earn your praise in Helsinki?
First and foremost, I just wish and hope that he doesn't fall over himself to praise Vladimir Putin. This is somebody who has built an autocratic regime inside Russia. He has annexed territory of his neighbor. He has supported a brutal dictator in Syria. And he violated our sovereignty in the 2016 presidential election. So do not praise Vladimir Putin. Number two, I would hope that he would restate American policy positions on that list that I just articulated. And number three, I think he should engage on things that I think are of mutual interest between Russia and the United States. And first and foremost on my list would be a substantive discussion about arms control.
What's your confidence level that you'll see any of that in Helsinki?
Right now, not very high, for the simple fact that I'm listening to what President Trump is saying. When President Trump says on Air Force One, when asked, will we recognize Crimea as part of Russia? And he says, well, we'll see what happens. That doesn't give me confidence. When he talks about, you know, reducing our troops in Germany, that doesn't give me confidence. And when he tweets out, Putin said he didn't interfere in our elections, that doesn't give me confidence that he's going to be pushing hard back on that issue. I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong because I think the stakes are high here. But so far, the signals that our president have given don't give me cause to be optimistic.
Stanford politics professor Michael McFaul was ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014. Thank you, Ambassador.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's summer, but it's not a relaxing time for many French students. Thousands are in limbo. They don't know where or if they'll be going to a university in the fall. And it's all because of a controversial new law. As Rebecca Rossman reports, some critics say the law chips away at France's tradition of égalité.
It's a hot day in central Paris, and about 300 students are making their way down the Boulevard Saint-Michel. Samuel Roman came here from the heavily immigrant suburb of Saint-Denis. He's 16, and he tells me he's nervous. This is his first protest, or manif.
It's a new, the first manif that I make, but I need to come and scream to say I'm hungry.
Roman is angry because he was counting on going to university to study psychology starting in the fall. But a new law aimed at making French universities more competitive means that might not happen. The law gives public universities the autonomy to select and reject students for the first time in 200 years.
They want to break the way universities work.
Joanna Simient-Germanos is a philosophy professor who spent 11 years teaching at the Sorbonne, France's premier public university. She tells me that until now, just about any French student looking to attend public university has been allowed to sign up, as long as they pass their high school baccalaureate exam. Tuition is only about $525 a year.
when I was welcoming the students at the beginning of the academic years, I was saying, yes, I know the ceiling is not very nice and there are crackings everywhere, but you know, remember, you just pay 450 euros. Would you be in NYU or Columbia, you would pay 45,000 euros a year. And we are not 100 times worse than, let's say, our American colleagues. We are quite high quality and low price.
But open higher education has come at a high price for the government, which has had to deal with overcrowding and high dropout rates. Only 40% of public university students here make it past the first year, which is why the government says it decided to overhaul the system.
These arguments are good arguments to ask the question.
Emmanuel David Enkoff writes about education for Le Monde. He says he understands why the government has decided to make schools in France more competitive. But what has many concerned is the fact that the government has shown almost no transparency in explaining how students are being selected.
One of the most important problems with this law is that the criteria are not very clear. It's, you know, very dark and frightening for the students because they don't really know on what criteria they will be selected.
Samuel Roman says he's concerned.
I'm really worried.
He says of the four schools he's applied to, he was waitlisted at one and rejected by the other three. He's one of nearly 200,000 students across France who haven't received a single acceptance, a quarter of all students applying for a university spot this year. In Saint-Denis, the working class area where Roman lives, the percentage is even higher. 65% of students have been shut out. Roman doesn't think it's a coincidence.
The students from Paris have more chance than the student of ghetto of banlieue parisienne.
He says the new system favors students from Paris over the immigrant suburbs. But again, it's hard to know if that's true because the French government hasn't released the selection criteria.
Ce qui s'est passé, c'est que effectivement, dès les premiers jours qui ont suivi
Stéphane Troussel is the president of Seine-Saint-Denis, a cluster of northern suburbs where students have been hit hard by the law. In May, Troussel sent the Minister of Higher Education, Frédéric Vidal, an open letter asking her to make the selection criteria public.
Moi, je demandais tout simplement à la ministre pour éviter que s'installe ce doute.
I said, in order to relieve people of this doubt, this unjust feeling, this feeling of discrimination, why don't you just publish the criteria?
So far, Vidal hasn't done that. But she has given interviews where she's reassured students that most will have a spot at a university come this fall, though it may not be one of their top choices. Students like Samuel Roman say they're not convinced. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Paris.
There's the World Cup for soccer fans, and for tennis fans like me, there's Wimbledon. At this year's tournament, organizers are trying out a new technology. They're using an artificial intelligence system developed by IBM to create highlight videos from the matches. Those videos are for fans who, like me, can't catch every moment of the action live. We wanted to find out more about how AI picks out the defining moments of a tennis match and then stitches those moments together into a highlight reel. So we reached out to Alexandra Willis with the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club, which runs the Wimbledon tournament. She told us there's a couple of things the AI technology has its eyes and ears out for as it monitors every match.
The first is crowd noise level and crowd excitement. The second is actually the players' emotions and reactions, and that is using visual recognition technology. And that helps the system identify whether a player is either celebrating a point won or despairing at a point lost.
And what exactly is it looking for in a face or a reaction? What is it taught to pick up on?
So it's taught to pick up on fist pumps or players sort of exclaiming, so changing their facial profile. It's also taught to avoid certain things. So it's taught to avoid the player gesturing for a towel, which they do regularly. So that's really important as well, is helping it know what not to look for as well as what to look for.
Will the AI technology also pick up when players express negative emotions, and will those be included in the highlights?
Yes, it does. So if a player was to yell or to sort of gesture aggressively towards their player box, which some of them are prone to do, it would probably flag that and say this is worth looking at. And I think for us is that's helpful because we want to present a balanced view of the match.
As you know, Wimbledon participants, they come from all over the world. And I'm wondering if people's facial expressions and how they react emotionally vary according to where they come around the world. And so how does the AI technology account for that?
I think it's a very good question, and I have absolutely no doubt some players are much more demonstrative than others, depending on where they're from. And what's brilliant about this AI technology is it's able to learn and account for those. So say we were watching a match from some very passionate Spaniards, we might see the system upweighting player emotion as something to look for. Say we were having a look at a match between two ice-cold Swedes, the system may be able to acknowledge that they're demonstrating less emotion. That doesn't mean the match isn't exciting. It just means that that's their sort of natural demeanor, and therefore it would upweight crowd interaction and the actual points in the match.
Will the AI technology be creating the entire highlights reel, or does a human look at it and make edits afterward just to make sure it's correct?
So a human is able to review it if they want to, and we see this as a great combination of man and machine, because the machine is essentially empowering our team because it's so much more efficient. But that said, there is the ability for this to be completely automated and for the content to appear magically on Wimbledon.com and in the official apps if we wanted to.
Do you have a sense of how much time you're going to save having the AI technology pull together this reel?
Yes. So typically when we were using the traditional method of different editors putting together highlights packages, we would be receiving them about an hour after the conclusion of a match. In this scenario, with a fully automated process powered by AI, we get the access to those highlights within 15 minutes. The other thing that is very significant also is it expands the number of courts that we're able to cover. So when we had human editors looking at and assessing matches, the most that they were really able to do in a day was around six, whereas we now have the capability to create highlights from every court of every match played each day.
As the tournament progresses, will the AI technology be able to learn and improve its approach based on the data?
Absolutely. So this is where the ability to have a human overseeing it is really important, because if it was to use the previous example, constantly be taking clips of players asking for a towel or maybe asking for the trainer to come on the court, those aren't necessarily the points that we want to include. So it then acknowledges that that's not what it should be looking for.
Alexandra Willis with the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
We've been hearing a lot in recent months about the thousands of migrants being detained at the U.S. southern border. Many of them don't speak English. Last month, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said that U.S. officials are equipped for the influx.
All U.S. Border Patrol personnel on the southwest border are bilingual, every last one of them. They are directed to clearly explain the relevant process to apprehended individuals and provide detainees with written documentation in both Spanish and English that lays out the process and appropriate phone numbers to contact.
But some migrants don't speak Spanish. About 3 million people in Guatemala speak one of several indigenous languages, and there's a shortage of interpreters to help Guatemalan detainees navigate the U.S. immigration system. New York-based reporter Ashley Cleek talked to a few of these interpreters, including Jose Gonzalez.
So Jose's interesting. He immigrated to the U.S. in the 1990s from Guatemala. He actually came through the Reagan amnesty. He speaks Canoval. He also speaks Spanish. He worked for many years teaching Mayan languages. Then he worked actually as a code enforcer in Jupiter, Florida. He would basically give like an orientation to new immigrants. So telling people, this is when trash is picked up. This is the noise ordinance. This is where you can get a business license. And he loved it. He really kind of saw it as a way to introduce his community to America.
Now Jose is helping kids and parents who've been separated at the border. How does that work? What's his first interaction with them like?
So Jose started working as an interpreter like 3 years ago. And what often happens is that he'll get calls any time of day or night from a number of a language line. He works for different interpretation services. And Jose says that the person speaking to him, whether it's an immigration officer or someone at one of the government shelters where children are being held, oftentimes they don't even know the name of the Conjoval speaker that Jose is supposed to be interpreting for. So Jose will say, "Hi, my name is Jose. How are you? I am here to interpret for you. Do you understand me?" Because a lot of times the language that Jose speaks, Conjoval, is not the same language that the person on the other end speaks. There's so many of these languages. And most of the kids and parents, the first thing they say to Jose is, "Help me." Jose describes him as being very anxious.
Based on the impression I get from the conversation with the kids is that they come with someone and they're missing that person. And their first question is, "Where is mom?" Or "Where is dad?" Or "Where is my brother or my sister?" And unfortunately, sometimes I don't have any answer for their question. As I said, I am just an interpreter.
Ashley, can you tell us about one case that Jose has been helping with?
There's one little girl, she's around 8 years old, Jose thinks, and the social worker tells Jose that she's been misbehaving. Kids in shelters aren't supposed to hold hands or touch each other. She's been touching other kids. She's been taking things that aren't hers. And the most recent call Jose had to interpret with her was with a psychiatrist that the shelter had called in. And the psychiatrist said that, you know, there's nothing wrong with her. She's just in shock. She's going through trauma.
Say, in the case of that girl, do we know yet whether she's been connected with her family?
We don't. Jose doesn't even know, really, her family situation. He knows that she keeps asking about her father and that she's missing her father, but it's unclear if she was separated from him or if he's somewhere else.
What kind of challenges do interpreters like Jose face when they're trying to help?
So I think one that we talked about is that there's so many languages that oftentimes interpreters get called for the incorrect language. The other problem is there's a lot of words in English that don't have direct translations into Mayan languages. I spoke to this one interpreter. Her name is Carmelina Cadena. She speaks Acateco and Conjoval, and she told me the word confidentiality has no interpretation for it into Acateco.
Confidentiality, yeah. Confidencialidad in Spanish. In Acateco, it would be Ashkamasanese Chicala, Masanese Tohavala, Ashkamasanese Yadal Alekati, Okanku Sholk, and Maxical Aloe, Umalkatu, and Maxical Aloe, Ukanetikatu. That's confidentiality.
What did you say?
Everything you say, everything you can say, everything you can hear will be kept here within the walls where we're at. No one's going to go out and divulge this information to anyone else.
And of course, these are kind of legal issues, and sorting out details of each child and their parent, this has real bearing on their future.
It does. I mean, it's the beginning of many of their asylum claims. And if they don't say something because it's not interpreted correctly, or if they're uncomfortable and so they don't tell the full story, it can really harm their case. It will follow them for years.
Did you talk to Jose and Carmelina about how they feel as interpreters in the immigration process? I guess I'm curious whether they wish they could be doing more.
I mean, definitely both of them come from like a very personal place of not understanding English when they first immigrated to the U.S. Jose told me very clearly that it's kind of been weighing on him that he can't do more, that he is just an interpreter.
Based on what I hear, I haven't seen any of the individuals I've spoken with, but there is fear in their voice, there is sadness, there is pain. To me, it's in this time and age, I don't know if I can't find the right word, but it shouldn't be acceptable anywhere in the world.
I think Jose and Carmelina, they wish in certain ways that they could do more, but I also think they really see their job as helping their community be understood.
Ashley Cleek is a reporter based in New York. Thanks a lot, Ashley.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Finally today, we wanted to play some new music from eBay. The French-Cuban sister duo released their latest album, Ash, back in the fall. Now they're back with a new track with Brazilian rapper Emicida. The song is called Hacia el Amor, which means towards love. It's a punchy track that eases itself into a message that's all about global unity.
Cat, bird, snake, horse, we all bleed the same color.
We've had
Ibeyi on the show before, but if you missed that, here's a quick refresher. Sisters Lisa and Naomi Diaz tend to blend several elements of their ancestry and heritage, Cuban, French, Nigerian, Yoruba, and end up creating these gorgeous multilingual sound portraits. Ibeyi, featuring rapper Emicida, put the raps on today's show with their new song, Hacia el Amor. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow with a 4th of July edition of The World. Hope you can join us.
PRI, Public Radio International.